I think Smith would be a little bit frustrated. If you could put him in a time machine and bring him forward, he would say, seriously? Really? Y'all are still doing this? Because it seems crazy.
Michael Munger, welcome to Schweizer Monat.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations was published 250 years ago. Do you think this anniversary is more important than the anniversary of the United States 250 years ago?
It is interesting that the two anniversaries are happening so close together. And what's cool is that it's almost exactly 250 years ago. So Wealth of Nations was released on something like March 8th or March 10th, 1776. And in it, Smith makes some predictions about what's likely to happen and what he hoped would happen with the American colonies. So the two things are actually linked. And there was just something in the zeitgeist. There was a sense that there were changes, and Smith partly recognized, but also partly forecast, what was going to happen as a result of what he called the Project of Natural Liberty. And so I think that the two things probably can't be separated, although they happen far, far apart. Some of the main causes were related.
Right. So you wrote an essay for us on the 250th anniversary of Wealth of Nations, and you make five central points. What is the most important from your perspective? What is the most important thing about Wealth of Nations that's still relevant today?
The thing that people miss about Wealth of Nations is that they talk about the invisible hand, which is a metaphor that Smith used three times, always for a different purpose, only once in Wealth of Nations. And I don't think that Smith's main point is that markets left to themselves produce really good outcomes. His main point was division of labor. And so if you were to have just a one-phrase summary of the importance of Wealth of Nations then and now, it's division of labor. And the way to think about that is the make or buy decision. Smith says that it would be strange if the master of a house asked that within the house, we make this thing if we could buy it more cheaply from somewhere else. Because if you can buy it more cheaply from somewhere else, that means that you have something, resources left over to have even more stuff in the house. So division of labor is a deceptively simple, because it's also complicated, observation. And that observation that Smith made about division of labor means that a whole bunch of things in society have to happen at scale. And scale requires not just that we trade with other people in our city, it's that we trade with other cities around our country, and that we trade with other countries around the world. And so this commercial process wants to be global, and we'll all be better off if we can come to depend on each other. So Smith was very optimistic about the ability of commerce to bring people who were geographically far away much closer together and give them a sense of shared purpose. So it's actually a very optimistic view, and I think that's just as relevant now, maybe more than it was then, because we have better transportation, better communication. The world is smaller now than it was in Smith's day.
Mm. And still we have trade wars going on now, tariffs and so on. Do you think Smith will still be optimistic today?
I think Smith would be a little bit frustrated. If you could put him in a time machine and bring him forward, he would say, seriously? Really? Y'all are still doing this? Because it seems crazy. So I just completed, my essay was partly a kind of summing up of a 10-part podcast series that I did on my podcast, The Answer is Transaction Costs. And it's 150,000 words. I put all the transcripts together, and there's an enormous amount of information in Smith that I've tried to summarize over 15 hours of podcasts. But the main thing that he talks about is that if you look at what he said in Theory of Moral Sentiments, he talks about the fact that human beings care about each other and they care about the opinion of others. In Wealth of Nations, he talks about how self-interest can lead to good outcomes. You have to combine those two things. The Germans at the time, Karl Marx, called it Das Adam Smith Problem, because they're supposed to be a contradiction. They're not. You have to take them. They are of a piece. And mm-hmm. what that ultimately tells you, what Smith ultimately is saying, is that this system can work as long as we keep some sense of connection at the local level, but we have commercial connections at a larger level. And we don't have to love each other. Someone in South Asia doesn't have to love me to make a piece of electronics that I'm going to buy. I can rely on their self-interest, not on their love. But at the local level, we still need to have this sense of connection, community, and human fellow feeling. So Smith, you'd argued for all of those things. What we're seeing now is the same claim that Smith himself was specifically trying to address. And that was that the balance of payments is the key thing to be concerned about. Smith called that a stupid, ridiculous doctrine. And yet, the American president is still specifically saying we need to worry about the balance of payments.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think people still misunderstand this today? Or people, I mean, even the government of the United States?
Especially the government of the United States. Unfortunately, the government of Smith had a hypothesis that 10 years ago I would have said we had laid to rest. There was this weird triumphalism of liberalism. 10, 20 years ago, and it turned out to be that triumphalism is entirely misplaced. Smith said it's a coalition of two groups. One is the concentrated self-interest of the commercial groups that benefit from having tariffs. Because there's no question that labor unions and the United Auto Workers and Ford Motor Company benefit from having restrictions on having cheaper, better cars imported into the United States. That's a big benefit for that industry and those labor unions. And he said, necessary for this to work, there has to be this intuitively appealing, though incorrect, but still intuitively appealing ideology about trade balances. And it seems like if you just look at it, you can be a smart person, poorly informed, you look at this, we're buying a whole bunch of stuff from China in the United States. They're not buying much of our stuff. That's not fair. We need to correct that imbalance. It's just not true.
And but in general, what do you think is the biggest misunderstanding of Adam Smith?
The advantage of division of labor for making literally everyone better off. Or a different way to put it is that the argument for free trade is unilateral. I always surprise people when I say that. The argument for free trade is unilateral. Let's suppose, for the sake of argument, that China does have a bunch of unfair trade restrictions on U.S. products. We're still better off if we get rid of our restrictions on importing Chinese products, because it is as if China is taxing its own citizens. It's as if China is making products that are being purchased in China more expensive so that people can buy those products more cheaply in the United States. And Smith specifically talked about this, the restrictions that they had on wool, for example, in England in the 18th century, meant that you could buy English woolen clothing more cheaply in the Netherlands than in England. So the argument for free trade is unilateral. If I just get one phrase that someone who listens to this remembers, the argument for free trade is unilateral.
It's interesting. A few years ago, Switzerland scrapped all the tariffs, industrial tariffs, unilaterally. And some people were like, why would you do that? What do we get in exchange? And they missed the point that actually it's a benefit for all of us, for citizens. Of course, it didn't help us in trade negotiations that now happened.
That's an excellent point. I mean, one of the things, the people, my friends, and I have a number of friends who are big Trump supporters, they say this is all strategic. He's playing four-dimensional chess. So he's raising all of these things so that he can use that as a bargaining chip. I see no evidence that that's true. I think he honestly believes that a trade imbalance is just a per se problem. And so we have grocery stores in North Carolina called Piggly Wiggly. So if I go to the Piggly Wiggly grocery store, I have an enormous trade deficit with them. They don't buy any of my lectures. They don't buy any of my books. Clearly, that's unfair. So I spend thousands of dollars at the Piggly Wiggly. They buy nothing from me. There's just no necessary, so ending the sarcasm, there's no reason to expect any particular relationship between a pair of trading partners. I buy stuff from them. If they want to help their consumers, they should buy stuff from me. If they don't, that means they're taxing their own consumers. If you think of the world as being a place where we're trying to get rid of trade barriers, okay, maybe it's a bargaining chip. I don't see that. I see a competitive escalation of trade barriers. We're going the wrong direction.
Hmm. You also have a chapter in your essay that's called Smith's Big Miss. What's Smith's biggest mistake? What did he not foresee?
He wrote, and explicitly, he wrote Wealth of Nations as a handbook for legislators who would like to improve the economic well-being of their country. That's why it's called the Wealth of Nations. So what he's trying to do is explain wealth. His argument for what wealth is the ability of people to acquire the goods and services, the necessities and conveniences that make their lives better. So he thought that there would be a recognition by government that this, what he called the Project of Natural Liberty, would make business perform better. Smith also recognized, but he underemphasized, that business people often, even if they gather for purposes of merriment, will conspire to raise prices and restrict output. And so business and markets are opposed. Business and markets are opposed. And he has many examples of this. Business would like less competition. And if they can treat the government as a vending machine for favorable policy, they'll be happy to do it. So he wrote Wealth of Nations to say, here is why you, Mr. Government, should not be a vending machine. But I'm a past president of the organization called the Public Choice Society. I was editor of the journal Public Choice. Public Choice is a perspective on political science and economics that looks at politicians and government, saying that those people are probably just as self-interested as corporate heads. And so once you recognize that, it's a big benefit to government to be a vending machine, because if you sell policy, you get resources back. And so there's a complicity that I think Smith did not anticipate between organized business interests and many, not all, but many government officials, that it's not that they don't know what Smith said. Mm. They just think they can all benefit by having concentrated benefits that come from government and diffuse, dispersed costs that are imposed on all taxpayers, but it's hard for taxpayers to organize. So it's probably unfair, since he anticipated much of the development of capitalism over the next two centuries, we should probably give him a break. But he did not anticipate the problems that would come about as a result of representative democracy and concentrated business interests.
Mm. Yeah, I think your criticism is a bit unfair, because the government at his time was, of course, much, much smaller than it is today. And a bigger government, of course, also means more opportunities for all kinds of corruption and protectionism and so on.
I think it's entirely unfair, but it is, in retrospect, it is the thing that the possible counter argument that he did not anticipate. It is fair to say, how could he possibly have anticipated? Because none of these things nobody thought that these things were appropriate for government to do, and now we take them for granted.
Right. Yeah. So, and what's, how did you come to be fascinated by Adam Smith, and what's your personal, what's his personal relevance to you?
I worked, my dissertation advisor was Douglas North, who was an economist who won the Nobel Prize in 1993, and much of the work that North had was about trying to explain why it is that some nations are wealthy and some are poor. And there was a theory in economics that we should see convergence. And convergence just means, since we all know what causes growth and prosperity, then the wealthy nations at some point, having done that, they'll have pretty good growth. But the poor nations, once they embrace commerce, then we'll start to see convergence. And a big mystery in modern economic history and institutional economics is, why do we not see convergence? And Smith actually has an explanation. He has an almost evolutionary process, but he talks about the things that can prevent countries from making that next step. And so from Douglas North, I learned an appreciation for Smith. I also worked as a staff economist at the U.S. Federal Trade Commission in the first Reagan administration, which you're, if you're subtracting, boy, he's old. Yes, I am old. So it's been a very long time that I have been interested in the relationship between economics and regulatory rules and the performance of the economy. I have just become more and more convinced as time goes by that much of what Smith had said is not only still relevant, but is something that we should be reading as a way of understanding what's going on today. He was prescient.
Why?
To understand that there would be this coalition between organized business interests and politicians who were either confused or found that it was useful to be able to talk about the balance of payments. So there are things in books 3 and 4 that if you read them sound like they could be a speech right now from Donald Trump. So as I said, 20 years ago, I was less excited about Smith. But if you look at what the debates that we're having right now, these evergreen recurrent debates, Smith said, this will be very difficult. It's a hard problem to overcome. And you have to understand these basic principles. We economists, and I would blame myself, we've done a poor job of teaching this. We have these mathematical models and we talk about equilibrium. Smith is not interested in equilibrium. Mm-hmm. Smith is interested in the process by which commerce develops and grows. So Smith is a dynamic theory. Much of economics is a static theory. So we need to go back to dynamics and Smith can show the way.
And it's interesting. I mean, his thoughts were very radical for his time. I mean, you described this in your essay as well.
It is interesting that it was radical partly because it was an emphasis of a process that no one really understood because division of labor had not been elaborated. There were a few examples. But what division of labor means is that we divide a task up into several parts, and then we become better at each of the parts, and then we become better at each of the subparts. We start to develop tools, and we can teach future generations way to do this. So there's an accumulation of knowledge also. That was unknown. There were a few places where it had been mentioned, but the dynamic part of it, I don't know if he fully foresaw, but he laid out the mechanism by which the next 2.5 centuries have developed commerce.
That's interesting. Okay, Michael Munger, thank you very much for taking the time. And everybody who hasn't done it, please read his essay in Schweizer Monat. Thank you very much, and see you soon.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure.